Welcome to the Age Proof podcast, where we explore the science of longevity, performance, and health optimization. Through expert interviews and deep dives into the latest research, we bring you practical, evidence-based strategies to enhance health span and resilience. Serious conversations for those who take longevity seriously.
So welcome, Suresh Ratan, to the Age Proof podcast. Delighted to have you here.
Well, nice to see you also and talk to you, Piers. It was nice to be in touch with you, and thanks for inviting me to talk.
Very welcome. So for those of you who don't know, I'm just going to give you a little introduction to Suresh. If anyone spent a lifetime unraveling the mysteries of aging, it's Dr. Suresh Ratan. He's a true pioneer in biogerontology, and his work has shaped our understanding of how and why we age, challenging long-held assumptions and offering new pathways toward healthy longevity. From his groundbreaking research on hormesis, which is the idea that mild stress can actually enhance resilience and extend health span, to his discovery of the anti-aging properties of kinatin and zeatin, Dr. Ratan has been at the cutting edge of aging science for decades. His career has taken him from India to the UK, to Denmark, where he's led the Laboratory of Cellular Aging at Aarhus University since its inception. Along the way, he's authored, I think, around 20 books, hundreds of scientific papers, and played a central role in shaping the global conversation on longevity. But here's what makes him truly fascinating. He doesn't just study aging, he explores how we can thrive as we age, whether it's through biological interventions or even the role of stress as a positive force. His work is practical. So today we're going to be chatting around hormetin, cellular resilience, and the future of aging research. Plus, we might just hear about his unexpected passion, Indian classical music, and how he balances the rigors of science with the rhythm of the tabla. Dr. Ratan, welcome to the Age Proof podcast. And let's start with, what's the biggest misconception you think people still have about aging today?
Okay, so you are going directly to the head of the nail. Yes, what are the misconceptions? Well, there are still misconceptions because of the way science has been done and is being done, and also what we wish. The biggest misconception about aging and lifespan is that it's predetermined, that there is a limit. And there are certain genes which are trying to kill me from inside. And the aging is programmed. And so there is an enemy which we can then neutralize and live forever. I think that is the biggest misconception. And which actually was resolved almost 30 years ago. People like Robin Holytail and Hayflick, Kerfoot, other evolutionary biologists, they have been writing again and again and again that the cause of aging is not a gerontogene, a gene which causes aging. That's actually the term which I coined and published in 85 and then improved in 1995. And I have spent all my life trying to prove that gerontogenes don't exist. That is first misconception in my view, that we have to find the reasons for why we become old and why we eventually die, not in any pre-programmed methods, that there are specific genes which evolution has made to limit my lifespan and to kill me from within. That's the one biggest stuff. Then the second part is that just because over the last 50 years we have been able to show what happens from basic organ level, body level, all the way down to molecular details, and almost everything is known. There are still some things which that now we can correlate these things backward from bottom to up. That if you are feeling that DNA methylation has correlation, or telomere has correlation, or glycation, and there are 20, 30, whatever. And then I pick up one target at a time and give you some magic compound and it will improve your physiology, your function, your mood, your everything. No, that's the other misconception. Because aging research is still stuck into this reductionistic approach, which is fine, which has worked tremendously well for biomedical interventions. But a situation like aging, where there is no cause of aging, we can talk a little bit more about that. When there is no cause, when there is no enemy, where do you send your missiles?
Yeah. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So that is, these are the two points I would like to just start with. That these are, in my view, we have been on the wrong track even now. It was okay for a long time, but now we need to reconsider what we want to do and why.
Yes, that I like that, because people seem to frame aging as this kind of threat, and then you're in battle. And once there's a war on, there's no winners. So it seems to me, and also people are looking, as you say, for the secret missile that's going to solve all their problems. And that seems to be framing the entire debate in a way that's perhaps not helpful. Can you think of how we could, or how do you like to reframe that and think about it instead?
Well, this whole, as you mentioned, the whole rhetoric of war against aging, that hasn't worked. It's the same story almost for cancer research. War against cancer didn't work. Because what is even the cause of cancer? Apart from some clear-cut, some viruses where they interfere, cause of cancer is also the life itself. Cause of aging is the life itself. It happens. Nobody can deny it. But it is not pre-planned. It's not happening by the will of any either realistic entity or the imaginary entity. So there is no cause. So when we do in that part of the story, when we get into that rhetoric, war against, it always fails. And also the war metaphor or the rhetoric of war puts the blame on the victim. A cancer, oh, my father fought a war against cancer. And what happened? He lost. Nobody wins there, because that's the thing. So the sociologists, psychologists have started writing, working on that. Don't use this war scenario for the cancer patients. It makes them feel guilty about it, that if they had fought the war better, or their family, if we had fought, we would have won. No, there was no war to be won. You could manage it, you could expand it. So the same story is about anti-aging or the war approach. There is already so much ageism in the world that becoming old, nobody wants to become old. Yeah, why not? What's wrong with becoming old? Because society tells me that you are now dispensable, you can be invisible, you are not needed, and governments tell old age is a burden. Yeah. So once I asked in a very international meeting where there were economists and others trying to show us that how old age is a burden. And I asked them, can you tell me why old age is a burden without using the term finances or money?
Excellent.
Yeah. Then the whole argument collapsed. If it's a question of money, that means basically it needs to be reprioritized. How do we live? Why I, as an old person, become a burden? I am burden because somebody else is dealing with the god of money. So that's why. And then anti-aging. I know I am aging. I will be 1 year older next year than what I am today. And I should be against myself. I should approach my old age or my own self as with an anti-approach, feeling guilty about it, feeling hatred about it, and trying to go into denial. When I will be 72, I pretend that no, I'm 27, and try to behave as if I was 27. So both biologically, physiologically, and socially, I will have so much actually negative feedback. I will fall down from the stairs, jumping like
great. Yeah.
So the whole language of approaching aging, in my view, needs to be reconsidered, which some of us have been doing. Actually, we started using the terms healthy aging, etc., from mid-90s. But it's more in the last 5-7 years when healthy aging is being used more and more, and now even the next step, healthy longevity, longevity medicine. So there is a whole tsunami of those terms.
Yes.
But still, the basic point that understanding aging as Robin Holiday had written in his articles in the 90s, and I have been writing, is primarily a failure of maintenance. Our evolution has created our bodies, or they have evolved, not only ours, but any living systems, so that it should not die before certain period in order to grow up and reproduce. That is the only driver in evolution. Reproduction, when we talk about purpose of life of a rat or a cat or a Drosophila or a Homo sapien, the purpose is to be able to survive and reproduce. Now, evolution has worked tremendously to give longevity assurance processes. the processes which assure that within this species, this individual should have at least that much lifespan. And I coined the term essential lifespan for that. That what is the natural evolutionary expected lifespan of a species? I call it essential lifespan. This biodemographer, J. Olshensky, he coined the term warranty period. So that is where things should not go wrong at a mass scale. Otherwise, species will disappear. So Drosophila has an essential lifespan of about 7 or 8 days in nature. But in protected environment of the laboratory, when I do research on Drosophila, which I have done, it can live 1 month, 2 months. Same thing about rats. Essential lifespan of the species is about 1 year. But in the laboratory, it can live 3 years. So essential lifespan of Homo sapiens, you and me, is 45 years.
Is that right? Gosh.
Yeah, that is the calculation generally discussed by evolutionary demographers and J. Olshensky's and other. That around 45 is not a magic number, but around that. And if we see historically also, that even that lifespan was never achieved by most of the populations. Living beyond 45 was a big, big achievement. It is only in the last 100 years or 150 that some parts of the world are living double than that. Yeah? But there are still lots of countries in the world. If you look at the life expectancy chart from 2023 of the world, there are lots of countries where average life expectancy is still around 46, 47.
Yeah? Really? Gosh.
And the reasons are not in the genetics or biology. The reasons are in sociology. Yes. Biomedicine, clean water, infections. This is what we have got. So in my public lectures, I often tell people that if you are becoming old and you feel that you are in old age stage of life, congratulations. It's a privilege.
Yes.
It's a privilege. It's not a birthright. It's the great privilege achieved by human effort. Human beings have done it. No other animal in nature has done. We have done for animals when we bring them in the laboratory or zoos. Then they live longer. But our species has done it. Be happy, first of all. Accept that this is a privilege which you are enjoying for which nature did not ever intend it.
That's a lovely, positive framing of that. In fact, we were talking just before we hit record about your birthplace in northern India, Amritsar, and
yes.
The fact that that has a meaning that relates to immortality.
Yes. Yeah. Amritsar. Amrit means the water of immortality, the nectar of immortality. Amrit.
Fascinating.
So I was born in the premises of the holy temple there. So, well, that is more like a psychosocial story. That's what may have attracted me into the questions of life and death and old age and immortality or whatever.
So I was going to ask that. What was it as you became a scientist that drew you into this field in particular?
Well, any scientific career has many factors. Major factor generally is that which teacher impressed you at your university time? Who was the nicest guy who treated you well?
Yes.
So there are several subjects which are similarly very important. So that is what happened to me in coming in the field of aging when I was doing my bachelor's and master's in Amritsar. One of the teachers, it was a new department of biology, Professor Suraj Prakash Sharma. He had come from America after doing postdoc on aging, but he was such a nice, gentle guy. And during that time, I was half lost what I want to do. Should I become a scientist or a musician or a sadhu or so what? And he somehow realized maybe some potential in me as an academician scientist. He trusted me. And then, of course, so the person who gives you love and trust as a young student without putting you down, you want to be like him. And then I did my master's project on aging in insects with him. And that's where the story started. But at the same time, because of my family background, from the Sikh religious intellectual family. My father was a very well-known scholar on Sikh religion and also the commentator on the holy book of the Sikhs. I grew up in a atmosphere where there was always a lot of philosophic discussions. There was even these Hindu religious saints and sadhus will be coming to our home and living for months there. And my parents were always engaged. That really created this kind of a curiosity. What is life? Yes. Why we die? And the explanations coming from the religious aspects were not attracting me, even before I went to the university. And then when I started studying biology, and evolutionary theory started giving explanations. So these two things combined. Very nice. That, okay, I have that philosophic background and the scientific approach.
I love that because I'm very interested in philosophy also. And as you say, many of the sacred tracts of India talk about this who am I question.
Yes.
And there are various philosophical answers, but ultimately the answer is life, as you've said. It's this inexpressible vitality that runs through all of us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at some point, it's impossible to talk about that in words. It's beyond... Right.
Yeah, but we can try to talk, and where we cannot talk, then we become silent there. If we don't have answer to every question and there is a gap, we do not need to fill the gap with some ad hoc explanations, which don't add anything to the knowledge or wisdom. They just give you a illusionary solace, oh, as if I found the answer. No, you haven't found the answer. You have reached the place where you should be able to say, according to scientific way of life, I don't know. Yeah, this is that. Actually, it's very interesting, Piers. Just yesterday in one Indian newspaper, the Tribune, they have published my very short article. They approached me. They have a column going on about spirituality and science. And they asked me, would you write something? And I so wrote that scientific spirituality, is it possible? It's a very interesting, just 700 page, where I have given how I understand what is scientific thinking and then what is unscientific life. Saying what is scientific life is difficult, but you're recognizing when you are unscientific, that's possible for me. But that doesn't mean that I become a machine or robotic. How do I deal with my emotional issues? When there is a loss in the family, when my father dies or other, I also feel sad and lost. I also feel tempted. I also feel angry. Where do I get my life principles? Do I need to get from unscientific way, which I try to explain, or can science give me peace of mind, solace, comfort?
Wow, that's
hope.
An amazing question.
And all my life I have lived like that. My moral values and ethics must come out of science, because moral values and ethics came much before any other way of thinking in human history. Religions have appropriated it as if all the morality they can talk, but we haven't seen very good results from that. I don't need any spiritual aspects. So I might send you the link after we talk.
Please.
Today. You might like to read that little short article. Yeah. See, why do we need to combine these two? Let the spiritual people, if they feel good about it, I would like to be moral and ethical from scientific living. The question comes, why should I be moral and ethical?
Wonderful. I mean, that brings me on to...
Well, we are going in too many digressions. So
well, it's lovely because it is part of the overall theme, which is that longevity is a practice.
Mm.
And rather than some magic compound that you can just pharmaceutically ingest, but it's more about, and that seems to be one of the things you've propounded over the years, which is that it's about a long-term consistent approach.
Yes, yes.
So could you just sort of outline your approach? How do you live? What's your recommended way to maximize particularly the body's capacity for vitality?
Well, now, first of all, as we already talked a little bit, the approach in my mind, and which I would like the public also, the approach has to be that, yes, evolution has given us tremendously complicated, complex, dynamic longevity assurance processes. All these processes of maintenance and repair. You can start from basic DNA repair to translational accuracy to protein therapy, all the levels. These are what we call, they create my homeodynamic space, yeah, my survival ability, my health. And I don't also like the term homeostasis, because in living systems, which are very complex and very dynamic, there is no homeostasis. Homeostasis means same stage. Actually, in 1994, somebody, Yates in England, coined the term homeodynamics. It's a dynamic system. Yeah. First of all, imagine that there is no such thing which you can maintain or revert to a homeostatic stage. And as we discussed, because there is nothing killing me from inside, there are no gerontogenes, but health is failing and it will fail because evolution has not bothered to, say, extend it than its essential lifespan. So we need to do something about health. So it's the maintenance, recovery, improvement of health. And why health fails, there is another third important principle of aging research, because nothing is perfect in this universe, and hopefully also in the parallel universes. Perfection does not exist scientifically. It cannot exist. If perfection exists, there will be no change. If perfection was there in biological system, there will be no evolution. The first entity will be so perfect, it will just keep on reproducing it. We owe our existence to imperfections. And we owe our demise also to imperfections. It's the same story on both sides. So imperfections of our biological system, especially repair, maintenance, all this homeodynamic, that is what allows things to go wrong. Yeah,
love it.
There is no programmed, predetermined. People use the term sometimes adaptive homeostasis and all those kind of, so many other things are used there, or quasi-programs. But basically, the program is evolution just forgets once you cross the essential lifespan, because you are not a selection factor anymore. There are so few in nature that evolution does not have to do anything about it. Now, these are, so one has to read all these discussions by Olshansky and Kirkwood and Michael Rose, though, who have written tremendously, that how evolution works on survival, not on death. Even when there are death mechanisms during development, apoptosis and other, they are part of the survival strategy. You need to have that mechanisms to grow and to give shape or to remodel a skeletal system, immune system. Death mechanisms are very important survival mechanisms.
Yes.
Or apoptosis. So that I realized that imperfections of biology, of everything else, laws of entropy also mean the same thing, is the cause of aging. So I should, first of all, be happy that I am able to live beyond my species' essential lifespan, for which I am very happy and thankful for the last 500,000 years of great human developments, which involves technology, medicine, and even culture, society, everything in our species at least. And I should celebrate that part. Yeah. So for me, as I already said, it's a privilege. Now, but the fact is, things are going wrong in my body also, and my mind also. What can I do? I am not looking for an anti-aging thing to become young. Yeah? And I am not looking for anything to make me immortal. Because immortal I already am. You and me, we are immortal, the way I define, if there is no program to kill you. Theoretically, we are immortal, but practically, in real terms, tragedies, we die one day before immortality. So there is, because that is how the design of the body is. So there is, it's all interdependent that it will collapse. It is collapsing. Either we have to work on improving those parts, how to tweak on imperfections a little bit at a time and something. Yeah, or as a bigger level. So far, aging scientists are trying to find individual compounds and individual pathways to tweak on basically those things directly, defense and repair, or some other pathways. And the latest database of geroprotectors being run by João Magalhães, he's based in Berlin. There are 259 geroprotector compounds. Why can't we take them all together and live forever? Not one of the aging scientists will stand up and say, this is the compound I give you and you become actually young. All these compounds have some effect. Most of the data are still from animal studies, but some of them can be extrapolated too. They all have some effects, but none of them makes you young or live longer. So then that's where the thing comes that, can I find something that holistic? Yeah, that's a cliche word, especially when we use it without a W. It's a HOL, holistic, because yes. Every kind of hocus pocus practice, stupidities, religious practices, they all claim to be holistic. Presently, scientists like me and many, many other, thousands of them, we would like to be holistic, but with a WHOLI, holistic, with the whole body yes. and mind situation. We don't want to, but the problem with the society is, as soon as a scientist uses the word holistic, others just jump on it. Aha, that's what we were saying all the time. No. I wouldn't like to be equated with that holism. This is the holistic approach. The holistic approach, best paradigm, where so much data, scientific data is physical exercise. Now, what is physical exercise? Biochemically, it's one of the worst things I can do to my body. When I'm doing exercise, which is exercise basically means doing something extra than your normal day-to-day activity. When you are doing exercise, what is happening in the body at that time? Producing billions of more free radicals, acids, cells are dying. Everything is horrible when we do physical exercise. But everybody knows that over time, with repeated rounds of exercise over a period, it's not only the muscles you are working on get better, your immune system becomes better, your cardiovascular system becomes better, your memory becomes better, your cognition becomes better, your libido becomes better, everything. And this connection was not possible to be explained until about 25 years ago. Until people, where I was also part of that, started bringing in the ideas of hormesis. Because exercise is the best paradigm of the phenomenon of hormesis, which basically means that challenging your body with mild stress, and in our species, the mild stress of choice, will activate those 7 major stress response pathways. Not all together, but it will depend upon the stressor. Like if you do exercise, the first pathway which gets immediately stimulated, the stress response, is the heat shock response. It starts when you are doing the exercise, is the heat shock proteins are being produced. And then they will start doing a lot of other things. So that is very well written. That's I have several books on hormesis.
Yes, you're one of the real pioneers of hormesis, aren't you?
In aging, I tried to make it a bit more obvious. There were people already had the data available in the 50s and 60s, especially from radiation and many other compounds. But then there was so much power of this antioxidant theory that people were calling all those compounds, which we can talk more, the spices and other, they are antioxidative. No. Now the hormesis theory cleared it up that polyphenols, flavonoids, resveratrol, all these things, none of them is a direct antioxidant. They are not chemical antioxidant where they just quench the free radical. They induce the stress in the body, in the cell, and stress activates hundreds of antioxidative pathways. That is how hormesis works. When I eat, like a lot of studies done basically like on curcumin, yeah, this is the turmeric component. Now, turmeric component, curcumin, what does it do? It goes into the cell and then it creates oxidative stress. Because the protein, this KEEP protein, which is a transcription factor, is binding. So that protein denaturation or damage occurs. Cell says, I am under stress. And it activates hundreds of downstream antioxidant pathways to take care of that. And as a result, there is always an overshoot and you get benefits. Effects can look like antioxidative effects, end result. But the starter is a pro-oxidant. Same thing about exercise. If exercise does not induce free radicals or the damage, you don't get any benefit of exercise. People have done research on that on animal studies and even human studies, especially Michael Ristow in Geneva. where people were given very potent antioxidants, even through very dark chocolate. Yeah. So before doing the exercise and any beneficial pathway of it, they were all stopped. Because you need those oxidants. You need oxidants anyway for health. Yeah. Because without free radicals, immune system cannot work. Without actually, about 10 years ago, James Watson, Nobel laureate, he wrote a paper, Antioxidants Cause Cancer, after 40 years in field, because those oxidants and free radicals are needed to fight the cancer cells. Those are the pathways immune system also uses to recognize and kill. And if you take away these oxidants by antioxidants, then you actually give chance to the cancer cell to survive.
So that's fascinating. So it sounds like you shouldn't take antioxidants immediately after doing exercise. And are you saying, in terms of people taking them, you know, say daily, you could get a very potent polyphenol supplement these days. Should you use that with caution, or how do
you? Yes, again, because those are the combinations. Like exercise is another kind of, I coined the word hormetin. It's a physical hormetin which causes hormesis by inducing damage. Now, if you either try to neutralize that damage before you were doing exercise, the benefit of exercise will disappear. Luckily, most of the antioxidants which we take from outside on a daily basis, they don't do anything in the body. They just go through one and come. They keep industry working and you just produce very expensive urine. Yeah. And that is a good thing because generally normal healthy person has so much antioxidants repair systems in the body that given from outside generally does not get used. And there are data showing that if the body uses this externally provided antioxidant, it reduces its own levels to the equal level. So end result, you can never show, increase in your antioxidant levels anywhere. Yes, in the case of serial deficiencies, when the situation becomes acute, then you need to take all these as supplements, maybe vitamins and other. But taking it like some of the biohackers taking 120 pills every day, we have no idea what they are doing to their body, but good luck to them. They are spending their own money and doing these experiments for the rest of the humanity. Yeah. So I got distracted. So I don't know how far we came with that. So these hormetins, which is the agents which can be chemical hormetins, physical hormetins, and even biological hormetins and mental hormetins, things which gives a kind of a challenge to your body.
A crossword is a mental hormetin.
Yes, mental hormetin. Data showing meditation, crosswords, Sudoku. Yeah. When you play Sudoku and you get aha moment. Because the same thing you are watching. And people have, there are some data coming, especially from meditation, that people put in focused attention. They produce the same stress markers in their saliva. They can measure it. Because meditation, when you're doing it, is still the same story like exercise. You are spending more energy on doing something extra, which has certain stressful events. And the body, if it's healthy enough or its homeodynamics is reasonable enough, it will take care of it.
That's a fantastic, I've never heard that, because that suggests that one of the primary benefits of meditation is in fact the physical response on the body, and then you get the benefits in the mind.
Exactly, because at the same time, you're also blocking off all the other distractions of the monkey mind, all the noises and other thing. But basically that putting this thing into, that's why the researchers call it focused attention. They don't use the word meditation. Focusing your attention on something actually is pretty stressful. Even to watch your own breath going in and out 10 times, you get distorted after number 3 or 4. But keeping on track, that is why that these experienced Buddhist monks, where the data are available, and some practitioners of meditation in India, the art of living meditation part,
Ravi Shankar,
their basal levels of certain stress proteins are much higher than the ordinary people. So if you measure their just basal blood level of HSP 70, HSP 90, they're carrying on at the higher level. Yeah.
That's incredible, because we think of them as being so peaceful, but actually their systems are under stress in some way.
Mild stress of choice, yes, and that is keeping them peaceful. That is why they are peaceful.
I love that. You have to create some inner stress to bring about peace.
Exactly, because running away from stress is unstressful condition is actually death. Life is stress. So this principle of hormesis, which is basically the principle of biphasic dose response, that things which can kill you are required for your basic survival at certain dose. I am not even talking about the old thing, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Yeah, those things. That's the extreme case of hormesis. That is called the preconditioning and strengthening. But like we said in the aging, things which keep me alive are the ultimate cause of my death, which includes breathing, food, and basic biochemistry. And these are the ones which eventually also kill because imperfections of my bodily system. So hormesis to me is the best holistic approach which we can see. And exercise as an example sets the high bar. I don't think there is anybody in the world who can say that exercise does not have any good effects. Range and quality and quantity and age, there are so many factors. Even very, very old people, there are studies done by muscular biology researchers, people of age 85, 90, when they start doing exercise, they even start getting certain benefits. Of course, there is a law of diminishing return because the rest of the homeodynamics is shrunk. So you can only get benefit to something, but you can train to get more benefit. So if body is alive, it is responding to stress. So running away from stress is a different story. Running away from stress when you don't have a choice. Yes, the way we have created societies, the growth model, we have to always create, get, achieve. Those creates stresses which you actually don't like.
Yes.
So after a stressful day at your work, in the evening, you pack up the bag, go to a building, pay the money, and get more stressed. That's called exercise. What fun?
It's interesting. And also, the thermal stresses are very popular now.
Yes. In physical hormetins, where exercise comes under physical hormetin, then hot water, the spa therapies, cold water and hot water. Again, there are not many published papers on that. When I started publishing, I was approached by some sauna makers, dry sauna, that, guys, you can test our this, because my work was on heat shock. I was giving small heat shock to human fibroblasts, and they were not aging to the same extent. They were not living too long, but they were not, and at least there are 5 PhDs and 20 master's theses done after that observation, that how 41 degrees centigrade, 1 hour, twice a week, slowed down aging of human fibroblasts in the laboratory.
Fascinating. Then 41 degrees twice a week.
Yeah, but then again, there may be a better combination, but I was not able to test all combination. But that was in 1995 I did this experiment. Since then, there are hundreds of papers by different people. Those who used to call things antioxidative and other things, now they use hormesis. They may not use the term hormetin, but when they explain their data, you can see, this condition induced this pathway. This induced NRF2 pathway. This induced autophagy. The autophagy is so popular these days. Fasting, calorie restriction. Autophagy pathway is the stress response. And if something induces autophagy, that's a hormetin. All spices do that. Calorie restriction does that. Fasting does that. People are searching, lots of companies are searching for potential, which they call CR mimetics, calorie restriction mimetics. Basically, they are supposed to induce autophagy. Calorie restriction is good because it's bad. It actually induces stress. That is how it works. And the people in the field of calorie restriction wrote fantastic articles in mid-90s about it from hormesis' point of view. Hormesis, by the way, is not my word. That was coined in 1930s on a fungal toxic compound. The guy who has revived field of hormesis as a general is Professor Ed Calabrese in University of Massachusetts in Amherst, who had analyzed thousands of papers in toxicology, radiation biology, everywhere. and showing there is no such thing as the textbook linear curves. That whether at a threshold or non-threshold, every curve is hermetic. But people have been ignoring it because demonstrating hermetic was, by statistical methods, much more difficult because individual effects of hermesis are very small, quantitatively. One round of exercise cannot tell you much about what has happened into your body. It's biological effect. So as a result, if you see those graphs, there were spots there which people just ignored. But Calabrese has, he even published an article in Nature 10 years ago, an obituary to threshold linear curves, that all those curves are dead. Every curve is biphasic. So we have to find what is biphasic. Sorry, I get excited about this area.
It's fascinating. I'm loving it. And I was just reflecting that the sort of popularity of wearable devices now is going to probably radically change the whole field because the amount of data that's being drawn must just be exponentially growing.
Yes. Well, if it helps you to take your health from a positive point of view and not from a fear point of view, so far, anti-aging approach and other approaches have been with the same old style, the way ethics were promoted. I should be nice, otherwise I'm going to hell.
Yes, yeah.
Nobody told me why I should be nice anyway, without this fear or reward. That was, and it didn't work. It has never worked anywhere. Maybe it will. So same thing about disease fear, that I should take care. Otherwise, in so many years, I will get this disease or that disease or this disease. It frightens, but generally it doesn't work. I need to know why should I be healthy and why should I be healthy today? What is health for me today? We do not know how to sell health. We are selling fear. We are selling terror. And it doesn't work. It will work for a while. These monitoring devices are wonderful. And in one of the aging courses in Singapore, which I have been going 2 times of a 10-day course, where we were talking about these training young scientists. So I said, I have been using all of these monitoring devices for 3 months. And within 3 months, I lost more than 60% my will to live.
I love that.
Yeah, because then you're just obsessed about, when will I live? All the time I'm being interfered with some information coming about which I can't even do anything.
I do worry about Brian Johnson because...
Yes.
Yeah, I often think he could probably really benefit from a good night out on the town with some healthy amount of red wine and other. You know, because if your entire life is spent worrying about death, then you're missing out on the whole party.
Yeah, if you see his that latest documentary on Netflix, Don't Die, have you seen that?
No, I've not, but I've been...
Well, see that. Then it comes, then it gives a lot of explanation to why he's doing what he's doing. That fellow has, one feels so sympathetic towards him. He has such a horrible life.
Really?
And he's never happy. And eventually, by the end of the film, he starts saying he feels happy. And then I won't take away the punchline from you. You should see that.
I'll definitely watch it.
And his mother then says, I never heard my son saying he's happy. And why he's happy? Nothing to do with those monitoring and 120 pills and genetic engineering. Nothing at all. If you want me to tell the punchlines, I can tell you.
Oh, tell us. I don't mind.
No, sure. Because the whole film is about how he's taking care of that. And he's so tense, so stressed. And the way you said he should go. Eventually, he has created this movement where there are thousands of followers who are also buying. And he chooses to take them out and make a hiking trip where there are hundreds of people. And he has started that. Dear, after doing that, he started glowing. There was his
friendship,
his social life, his identity, his love he's getting from the people. He's realizing that I am also somebody. Not only this body, but also a mind. And that is where the beauty of life came. Yeah. And all those things, rubbish just disappeared where he's doing even parabiosis, giving his plasma to his father and young child giving to grandfather. All these things. Never happy because he had very messed up life when you will see it. It's a very sad life, very traumatized life. Yeah.
I think you've hit it. Yeah, so interesting. It's ultimately, people just want to be happy.
Exactly. And that is where even things like cosmetics help.
That's interesting.
Cosmetics don't do a thing to your biology. That is why they are called cosmetics. They are not supposed to do anything. If they claim that they can change something in the skin cell, FDA stops it. Then it has to go through drug pathway. Cosmetics should not do any immediate harm, but then it should not do any biological change. That's why they are called cosmetics. Why otherwise there are no drugs on aging? Because cosmetics are easy to produce. Cosmeceuticals are those cosmetics which have some very interesting compounds. But due to the regulations, they cannot use those compounds at the same level where actually they work. That is what happened with my story of kinetin and zeatin.
Yes,
they are powerful, powerful compounds. But the company who was giving the research grant to our university, they did not want us to even check biological effects too much. They wanted to produce into cosmetics. But if we show that, it changes your DNA or does, then it's in trouble.
I see.
So cosmeceuticals are quality cosmetics, which have some very interesting compounds, but they are still at cosmetic level. All cosmetics do is hydration maintenance, a little bit moisturization. Why I said it is they are good. Studies done in Australia and some in Japan, they showed that when they gave cosmetics to elderly persons in a elderly care home for 10 minutes to use in the morning, 10 minutes in the evening, so scientists knew that we are just giving this moisturizer. What will happen to them? And they were observing that within 1 or 2 weeks, their visits to the doctor decreased by 90%.
Oh, brilliant.
All this problem here and problem there and other thing, they disappear. Cosmetics didn't do anything. What they did was they felt good about themselves. Then they give smile to the other people. Other people give smile back. Their social lives were revolutionized. So that thing then gave me also the state that I used to speak against cosmetic. It's superficial. It's nothing, blah, blah. No. How important they are. So now I tell in my public lectures also, when you look in a mirror and you don't like something about your face or your appearance, please make it up. That's what is called makeup.
Yes, yes.
But you need to know that what you are doing is transient, superficial for a time being. Yeah. Either whether you use cosmetics or whether you take a Botox or whether you do the fillers.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need to do, they will work. But do something about what you don't like. The question important there is, I should also be able to find out, why don't I like what I have?
Yes.
Is it my internal feeling, or is the peer pressure, job pressure, or something? Why don't you wear the suit, Mr. President? Yeah. So that is the external. So he will end up wearing the suits. Because if that is the pressure. So I like to have my white beard and white hair. If I don't like, color them. It's easy. So that is where cosmetics are important. If it makes you feel good and you feel that you have done something. Same thing even about taking multivitamin pills. They don't do much if you are healthy enough. But if it makes you feel good that you have done something.
I love that. So you're constantly bringing it back to social and psychological well-being.
Exactly. In our species, that is much more important than biological interventions.
In terms of actually sort of bolstering our psychological and mental resilience, are there scientifically proven methods to do this?
Well, yes. That's the lifestyle factors. First of all, okay, we'll have to go through which way to start. I should maybe come to a definition of health. Yeah, we want to be healthy. But what does health actually mean? Is there, like United WHO's definition of health is a complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being. That's the official definition. Complete state of, where is that? I wanted to show you. Because, just a second. Because we are not doing the video recording, so that won't help. But that's just to show. So a few years ago, together with a philosopher, I compiled a book explaining health across disciplines. Talking about health without using the word disease. WHO says it's a complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being, and not just merely the absence of disease. That's their definition. Very good. So how do we talk about health? Because WHO definition does not say what is well-being. It just changes the word health with well-being. It's a useless definition. So here in this book, we bring philosophers, psychologists, demographers, clinicians, cardiologists, everything, dental care, talk about health without using the word disease. Very challenging. And then we ended up compiling a definition, which I had been writing before, that what is the health? Can we measure it? Like my homeodynamic space. So how to know that you are today healthier than last week or less healthier? Can we measure it without involving any disease? And that is where then the idea of using this medical concept, activities of daily living, comes in handy. Yeah, because they have very good 38, 40 markers, activities of daily life. You know, whether you can get up, whether you can change, whether you can grip strength. They're fantastic. There is, medical people know that very well. So then we created a definition, an absolute health definition is the absolute physical and mental independence in activities of daily living.
Yeah, I like that.
Physical and mental independence in activities of daily living. Absolute. But this is, again, equally useless definition because nobody can ever have absolute health. As soon as I need to use my glasses to look in focus or everything else what we do, looking for absolute health is absolutely, in a way, oxymoron to me. But unfortunately, that is the message somehow it our younger generation seems to be following, doing so much, looking for some absolute state where data are coming, what are the effects are happening, especially in the young generation on reproductive system and mental stress and other things. A real definition of health which came out from that understanding was adequate physical yes. and mental independence in activities of daily living, which allows then automatically use of medicines, technology, social life, everything, whatever is required for adequate health. And what is adequate for me today? First of all, today it was needed that I should be able to chat with you for 2 hours. Yeah. But this is, I'm not looking for absolute health. I need to define why should I be healthy today and tomorrow or after in 3 days' time if my grandchildren are coming to meet me. I need different kind of health because they are going to jump on me and make me exhaust everywhere. You know, I am not afraid of what is going to happen in 20 years' time, 30 years' time. And I am not also looking for health to go out and challenge my Danish tennis champion, Caroline Wozniacki, for a tennis match.
Yeah.
I use sometime extreme example of the health that maybe health one day for me could be able to get up from my bed and reach the toilet in time. And that is a real life situation for hundreds of thousands of old people.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are not looking for these government's ideas of health and pushing because that is wealth generated stuff.
Yes.
But health, I need to find health. So that then brings, how would I like to live my healthy old age? What do I do to do that? First of all, I have to be clear about my goal. What do I want to do with health? And what things will help me? Like, I would like to be able to walk every day and without falling. So I do that kind of exercise or walk around, which I need to do. Basic thing and the same thing about peace of mind and the food. Those are general common sense things. There is nothing special about it. But knowing it, choosing also stress of choice, deliberately doing something extra. Like in the nutritional, all these good things, all spices and other things which are being synthesized, they are good because they are basically bad. Yeah, they have no nutritional yes. value. What is the value of ginger, garlic, onion, turmeric? They have hormetic value. Mm-hmm. So these are the three, basically, one can use pillars of health, which I also, first of all, I need to understand and then try to practice. Three pillars, which I now call them the three, actually, the nurturing hands of health. Nutrition, food, and diet, first of all. And then physical activity. Third is social engagement. Yeah. How do we use, that might be our last part, actually, because I see we have taken a lot of time. But we can carry on, don't worry.
No, it's perfect. This is perfect. So the three pillars,
yeah.
Nutrition,
Nutrition,
movement, and some social activity.
Yeah. that why I used three terms there, actually. That was also very important. Nutrition, food, and diet. Yes, why there are three words? This book deals with that, actually. Nutrition is that biochemistry. All these chemicals, which we can take theoretically in the form of a pill. But nobody eats nutrition. Did you eat nutrition at lunchtime today? You ate food. And food is either animal-based or plant-based. But again, food is not the same food. When you tell me, Suresh, I have eaten, say, chicken, and I start imagining you have taken chicken tikka masala with spices and da-da-da, it's wrong. You may have done in a very different thing. We eat food in a social and cultural lifestyle, which is called diet. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Compare your breakfast in England versus breakfast of a Greek person, or Absolutely. Italian, or a Danish. We all have our cultural stories about our food. Food is a cult. That's why we changed them in that book. We came to a different kind of slogan, that we are not what we eat. I don't become eating a banana. I don't become apple by eating an apple. But I eat what I am. Why do I eat banana? Yeah. Why do I eat apple? Why do I eat that chicken tikka masala? Why do I eat this and that? Ignoring that part in our scientific research has done terrible damage. I live in Denmark, and if Danish dietitian makes a diet protocol for me for my diabetes too, that will just kill me after 1 week of depression.
Yeah.
So Mediterranean diet is very good for Mediterranean people and their lifestyle. What's wrong with Indian food? What's wrong with Chinese food? But science, as if we can deal with the nutrition. And nutrition is not what is keeping us alive. So that is where hermetic way of life, I will use the example of, let's say, food. How to use hormesis in your daily life consumption of food? That's where hormesis comes in practice. First part, there is which food is going to be good or bad for you does not depend upon the food itself. There is no good food, there is no bad food. It's a biphasic dose response. Everything can kill me. I can kill myself by drinking water. I can kill myself by... So first of all, the first principle of hormesis, which for your audience might be important, which again comes with the philosophy and psychology, must give you pleasure.
I love that. A subject much missing from this space.
And it has been ignored by this dominant reductionistic scientist. Psychologists talked about it. Sociologists talked about it all the time. Now some people are trying to bet. If something does not give you pleasure, most likely it's not going to be good for you. Especially food. Food is not a drug which, even if you hate it and it's bitter, that it will go and do something directly on that target. Food must give you pleasure. The problem with pleasure is we can be very weird. Yeah, sometimes we get pleasure from totally wrong things also. I do get pleasure by going to McDonald's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't tell me McDonald's.
But whenever I go, that's for an example, like when I come to England, I love to eat the English breakfast with those two bangers. And I call it heart attack diet, but I love it.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. Well, next time you're here, let's meet up for one of those.
So first of all, the pleasure can be weird. So we were actually trying to make certain research protocol, but we never got the money to do the research. Because McDonald's example is that I eat McDonald's, but then within 10, 15 minutes, a feeling of guilt comes in. And I start picking, hey, why did you do that? Yeah, just for the taste of that. This sense of guilt, which is from knowledge or culture, whichever way, we all have it. Intuitively, we know what wrong we have done. Now it comes, then how to check which pleasure is good for me? So McDonald's pleasure is not good for me for more than 7 minutes. Huh? And I then promise myself I won't go there. Then after a month, I go there again. So then we wanted to see. So we made a non-scientific, that will be the only non-scientific statement I'm doing in your podcast.
Yeah.
That a pleasure which stays with you for at least 3 days.
Okay, that's a nice time frame.
A sustainable pleasure. That will tell that that pleasure is fine, a sustainable pleasure. Why 3 days? It was just random because I wanted to test with psychologists and clinicians, because after all, guilt feeling is also biochemical oscillation in the body. Can, like we know, the pleasure molecules and the happy molecules and oxytocin, are there any molecules associated with guilt? If I can study the appearance and disappearance, or make the curve of my guilt feeling and disappearance.
That's fascinating, because if that were discovered, it would be a very marketable commodity. Imagine the guilt tablet. You could just pop a few of those and then...
No, that I wouldn't like to have, because that is again going into the fear part.
Well, exactly.
That I will like to have the inhibition of guilt. That where, what are the things which keep my guilt suppressed for at least 3 days? Those are my pleasure molecules. Pleasure molecules which keep me in... Again... It needs to be, that's why I'm already said the disclaimer. That's the least scientific statement at the moment. Yeah. But for me, food must give you a pleasure, and any other hormetin, whether it's a social engagement or whether it's a mental hormetins, must give you pleasure. And it should be a sustainable pleasure. Weird pleasure, getting drunk with the alcohol and then vomiting out there, and everybody then having complaint. Everybody knows what is a bad pleasure. If we can find our... So I won't spend too much time on that more. But pleasure should not be underestimated. Same applies. That's where this, I eat what I am, not I am what I eat. I need to recognize why I eat something and why not something. Second part, which you have already mentioned a little bit, but that is from the same biphasic curve, is moderation. Because the stress or the challenge or the system has to be in moderation. That's what the biphasic response says. Same thing can be a killer if it is high dose and chronic. Yeah.
Yes.
These data are more clear about exercise and other toxicology and many other things. About food, it is less clear, but it is very well known that if you are always overdoing, that's not going to be good for your both body and mind. Something, overdoing, even physiologically, you can start feeling bad about it. So moderation doesn't mean starving or fasting or the calorie restriction 40%. Moderation basically means not leaving some possibility of eating more, but you stop eating.
Yes.
It can be 5%, 10%. Because with our modern life, we have so much abundance of food that we do not recognize our satiety level also. All the time we are just putting in. More in all human history, even getting enough nutrition, food was the biggest challenge. So they did not have to practice moderation. They had to eat as much as they could because they have no idea when will be the next meal coming from. And that is how our genes have evolved. Because they were so unsure about, that's why the genes try to absorb food and keep it. That is the hypothesis or explanation for obesity and all those things and metabolic diseases. Thrifting. Because we evolved with uncertainty. Biggest issue was survival. We didn't know when we will get the next food. But now we have the food, at least in those countries where we have. And if we overdo it, we are doing damage. And if we want to bring hormesis, then we have to definitely, by choice, go down a little bit. That's why all this once a week fasting, twice a week fasting, intermittent fasting, all these combinations are being promoted by many, many popular scientists and the real scientists. And they work, they do help. But that kind of lectures I don't give to my audience in India. Fast. Oh, they are already starving and fasting.
Absolutely. And of course, the religious traditions all have this built in. You know,
they had fasting. They had other reasons for that also. Yeah, because then you get out from the competition of the thing. But these are human activities which those societies where these things, religion, philosophy, culture evolved, they were able to bring in those things. Yeah. Before that, because that was the choice, fasting by choice. Yeah, that when you have it. But those guys who are fasting because of non-availability, you cannot give them this illusion. It's actually helping you. No, that's a terrible way of doing things. Okay, so pleasure, moderation. And the third part of hormetic way of life is variety, variation. again, from exercise physiology, it's very well established that you should not do the same muscles every day. You need to give them variation because a lot of the hormetic good things happen when you are not doing exercise. Because hormesis is inducing the stress, benefits are coming when the stress is gone temporarily before the next round. So variety is very, very important. The combination of stresses is also, at the moment we have no data, I will just mention one set of experiments. Like we know curcumin has certain hormetic effects in the cells. We also tested. And then we also tested heat shock, which has hormesis. So then we said, can we combine curcumin and heat shock in our cell culture experiments? And we tried to do that. What we did was, if we give curcumin to cells 2 hours before giving heat shock, we saw synergistic effect, that the effects of heat shock were much more improved. Yeah.
You know, I've never read that. So you're
saying... No, because we have published it in a small paper. We never followed it thoroughly.
Fascinating. So technically, you could sell a lot of turmeric supplements to sauna providers as an additional benefit.
Before the exercise, when I give... No, other way around. After heat shock, which is the main pathway for exercise, if I give curcumin, cells died.
It's incredible.
Same concentration, same things. Timing. What it means is that, yes, if I have a spicy Indian meal, then going to exercise after the meal might be more beneficial. But if I have come out of the exercise and then I immediately start eating a very spicy chili-based food, it might do me more damage. But these things need to be tested clinically. And I became Professor Emeritus, grants are not coming, but these can be tested. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like a very interesting area.
I have written papers on how do you discover new hormetins and combinations? What should we do? All this, if somebody gives me a lot of money and a big institute, maybe I can guide them what to test on. But combination. And the third part of hormesis is none of the stresses in life work individually in isolation. Even things like turmeric. Who eats turmeric? You don't cook food only with turmeric, or if you can't eat turmeric, it's so taste less or horrible, you use turmeric together with black pepper, with cumin powder, with this, with that, and then you cook. That is how these things are actually taken. So those capsules, like the nutrition thing, we have no idea what they can and cannot do. Because things have to work. When haldi, turmeric, and kali mirch pepper go together, they have a totally different effect. They can even cancel out each other's effect. And then the timing, which meal, there are so many combinations which need to be answered. But first of all, we have to accept the philosophy and science behind it, that this is the choice of challenging your system with pleasure, with moderation, with variety. This is the hormetic principle of life. I'm trying to write, there are several popular publishers after me to write a popular book on hormesis. I just don't get time because I'm having this book series, so where we keep bringing very serious books. But that is needed for public, how to tell. But I do that in my hundreds of public lectures, Hormetic Way of Life.
I think that'd be a fantastic book because you have a very unique way of bringing in these aspects of culture and pleasure. And these things, I think, make it so much more absorbable, more interesting, and more a bit less puritanical. You know, we start to bring it into our lives.
Yes.
So yes. I'd love to see that book.
No, because some of those things are already written. A few years ago, my university has these very small books, 60-page books. They call Think a Pause. So I brought this book called Age. It's also available on Amazon or somewhere, where I talk about, these are the books created by our university. One word topics, they have 115 titles now in the last 10 years. This was number 45, 115 now. So where we tell about all our life knowledge about the subject for general public. And these are sold for about $5 or something. This is, it was originally published in Danish as Ella. Then my book was so popular, they also published immediately in English. I think now the John Hopkins University is bringing the re-edition. This book is also then translated in Polish and Turkish, and very recently in one of Indian languages, my language, Punjabi. This is where I talk about a lot of philosophy, sociology, psychology, based in hardcore biology, which is my professional
that
training.
Sounds, yeah, I'm definitely getting a copy of that.
Yes, yeah, so this you can. Yeah, I wish I could send you a complimentary copy. I got some copies to take to India. A day after tomorrow, I'm going to India for 10 days for several conferences. But this age book, now hormesis, hormesnic way of life, demands also understanding the science of aging, biogerontology. That what are we looking for? What do we want to do? Are we killing it? But now going to repeat some of the early time. Are we trying to neutralize anti-aging and some kind of enemy? Or are we trying to find methods to promote health, recover health, and maybe enhance health? Don't worry about the length of lifespan. That may or may not be affected because you are immortal anyway. Health span is also a buzzword. But doing these things will not give you that end point immediately because you have to live your life on a daily basis. And don't worry about diseases also. There are data full in public literature. People doing everything so-called good still getting diseases because there is again a chance element. These imperfections basically mean chance. Things go wrong. So if I have to say something finally for old age and living old age, there are three, again, buzzwords. First of all is acknowledge. Acknowledge that you are living in old age and you are going to become old. Yeah. Acknowledge, anerkennelse, and then acceptance. That yes, whatever is happening, you have to observe it and do something about it. If it's an acute situation, you have to run to the doctor to get a stent or a hearing aid or whatever. But that is by accepting, not denying, and accepting the technology, all the things which are available. Acknowledging that you are getting old and you are living, because you are living, you are getting old. Yeah. Like people say, obesity. Obesity is the biggest, maybe, anti-aging factor because it kills you without making you old.
Yes.
So acknowledge, accept, and then comes challenge. This is the three-word formula. Challenge your body and mind both. Mind challenge comes by social interactions, by reading, by philosophy, by art, by music, all these things. You should have that. You can, but then of choice, I cannot make the formula for you. You need to find out what kind of challenges. Don't run from challenges. If you are living, life is dealing. Every time I breathe, I create a challenge for my biochemistry to handle that. That is when the processes happen. And oxygen, while doing everything, also does all those bad things also. And those are the ones which keep my immune system going, my remodeling going on. So these are the three secrets, philosophic secrets, but in practical terms. Hormesis is, yeah.
That's absolutely brilliant. I feel like, I know you don't like the word holistic, but I feel like you do have a particularly well-rounded look at this subject. And you're not just limiting it to science, even though you are a scientist. You're bringing in, you know, basically spiritual and cultural aspects and saying that we need to live a well-rounded life. And that's the true secret. It's not about...
I will prefer to avoid the word spiritual, but that's what I will send you the article. But that is the basic moral, ethical, happy life is scientific life. Science gives me all answers. I don't need to use anything spiritual. Basically, for me, spiritual means involving something beyond humanism, something supernatural. If I can get rid of that, and then behave ethically. Actually, once I gave a lecture on scientific spirituality, and one of my friends, he really, why do you want to call yourself spiritual? You want to feel different from people? If somebody tells you, Suresh, you are a scientist, isn't that the highest compliment? Why do we need these extra words? Because of that power. So that is what this article I have written, where I haven't attacked on spirituality. I have just presented what science for me is. And those who are intelligent enough, they can read between the lines that what I'm... Because in present times in the world... saying things against somebody is very dangerous.
Absolutely.
And I still want to live happily as much as I can.
Thank you. So I was going to say, just to wrap it up, what are you most excited about as this field obviously is evolving very rapidly now with AI and so forth?
Excited?
Is there anything which you really feel is going to be really game-changing in the next decades?
No magical compounds, no magical treatments, because general thing, if once I did a survey with my 100 colleagues, give me only 2 or 3 points, what is the healthy secret of life? And everybody comes with basically same 3 things, food, physical activity, and social engagement.
Interesting.
And within each one, can you even rapamycin people who are pushing that thing so much, they're all falling apart. Even I think Brian Johnson has stopped taking rapamycin because he's seen some negative effects of that. So I am not excited about any magical compounds, but I am excited about magical knowledge, which is coming and people are listening to that. We just need to talk more. Those guys who get more media time and success in money, the investment anti-aging longevity industry, if it's an investment, they are looking for returns and then they are giving false hopes and exaggerated claims. I wrote a few years ago an article after giving a lecture to British Society on Research on Aging. Naive extrapolations over hyped claims and other is dangerous for biogerontology. And all these industry people are doing still that because they have to sell their compound. And they have to sell their compound because investors want their return in a year or 2 years. Otherwise, there are billions of dollars. Knowledge-based, if some people can bring this total lifestyle, biology, sociology, psychology, philosophy, economics, and at an individual level, I won't even react to religion. If that helps you, okay, good luck to you.
Yes.
But that's, for me, that's like a cosmetic. If it makes me feel good, okay, take it. But usually it doesn't make you feel good. It makes you feel gay. So all those things have to be brought in and recognize why people, what are they looking for? When you ask people, this is my pill, which will make you young and live you for a long time. Do you want it? Nobody buys in my lectures. Because people's priorities are different from scientists' priorities.
Yes.
The top area where people want from an aging scientist in public is always mobility in old age. Brain comes number 6 or 7.
Is that right?
Yeah, there are data done by sociologists also. First is mobility. I should be able to move. That's where the definition of health also comes. Second is, again, that's incontinence. I should be able to control my bowel movements. These are all psychology related.
Yes.
In Denmark, our health service is so good, but still, it's only once a week a person is coming to meet the old man who is lying in the bed for several hours or days in his shit.
No way. Oh, that's this harsh, isn't it?
Same story must be there in England.
Yeah? I'm sure. Probably double
and,
the
and
days.
And for an old person, that's so humiliating to live. Somebody has to come and change his nappy. Incontinence. Third point comes in sociological research is appetite. My taste for food, which goes with age. Brain comes later on. What will I do with a brilliant brain when I am lying? And then actually I will suffer more because then I will know how horrible my life is.
That's incredible.
But science gives money to the brain always because we are obsessed by brain.
Yes.
That's why these post-humanists, they would like to talk, even download all your personality and everything, your brain in a computer. We don't even need a body.
Yeah.
So that is their approach. The 3-body problem film deals with that, I think.
Yeah, that's a brilliant film.
So, but that is the solution they find is you can download a person. Because we are obsessed with brain. And that brain will go there and then recreate everything. Okay, well, that's a film. So brain gets maximum money because, again, of the fear approach. Alzheimer, Parkinson.
Yes.
And what has happened with Alzheimer? 50 trials failed because the reductionistic approach never worked. Because they were trying to eliminate amyloid.
Right, and now they've seen that that's needed. Is that right?
Yeah, because at early stages, formation of amyloid is a hormetic reaction. It protects you. But because this is that enemy. Because we live with that approach, we need to pick up on something simple. If there is no enemy, then we create the enemy and send the missiles. Yeah.
I think that's the one thing that's gonna linger with me most from our conversation, which is, let's get rid of the enemy and find balance and pleasure.
The word
pleasure.
Balance is still difficult because balance is, again, it becomes individualistic because balance theory, everybody has taught, but we have to maybe use something that this acknowledgement, acceptance, and challenge, yeah, whatever ends up with that. And holistic, scientists want to be holistic, but I will like to spell it with a due H-O-L from the English spellings of whole. Whole mean total, not a hole mean where I just fall down. Yeah. So I hope you can get some things out of it and use it the way you want to use it. I have no problem.
Suresh, it's been so fascinating. I've really, really enjoyed it. I hope we can talk again. You've got a unique approach to this. And just for the listeners, your website is sureshratan.com. That's SureshRatan.com. And is there anywhere else that people can find you?
Well, basically also on Facebook and LinkedIn. And I don't put too many things on Instagram, but Facebook and LinkedIn, I sometimes keep updating.
I'll put those in the show notes.
Yes.
But thank you so much. Wishing you a great trip to India for your lectures.
Yes, thank you very much.
It's been great fun indeed, and I hope we speak again.
I hope so again. Thank you very much,
Piers.
Nice talking to you.
Good. Goodbye. Check.
Bye.
And just before we wrap up, remember that everything shared on the Ageproof podcast is for information and entertainment only. It's not medical advice. Always consult your GP or a qualified professional about your health concerns. The views expressed here belong solely to each speaker. If you found today's chat helpful, we'd be thrilled if you liked, shared, or subscribed, because that really helps our community grow. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.